Due to extreme atmospheric conditions, an anticyclonic storm has raged on Jupiter's surface for over... Yes, Dwight?
I wrote a song about him.
Oh, this may not be the time for a musical performance. That's, Jess Montana?
Now, pardon the interruption, June. The boys and I heard old Dwight was scribbling up a little warble, so we learned ourselves to play it.
Dear alien who art in heaven, lean and skinny, about 6'7". Don't we know you ain't our brother, or you friend or foe?
Or other.
Hop on 1 foot, skip on 2, dance the face with hat lady. Sound on 4, swing on 3, left face face with hat lady.
Hello and welcome along to a solo cast here from What's So Great About Productions. It's me, Terry, bringing you my top 10 movies of the year 2023. I know we're in mid-Jan now at this point, but I just want to... I'd set myself a goal, really, of doing a particular list for this year. I kind of wanted to do it last year and never got around to it with having a new baby and stuff like that. And I really made a concerted effort this year with Letterboxd and stuff like that. I was keeping up my loggings and my, you know, my star ratings and reviews and stuff like that. So I made a list on Letterboxd of the movies that I saw. I actually put like a top 24. I couldn't find a 25th one yet. And spoilers for this, there are movies that I missed out on, stuff like Ferrari and Past Lives. I missed out on the new Miyazaki one, The Boy and the Heron. Just haven't been able to get to the cinema to see them. But I did fit in a few that I didn't think I was going to get over the line. So that's why I gave myself the deadline of 15th of Jan to watch what I could and what I couldn't. Well, I'll probably come at you with a solo cast on the Patreon, maybe, with details of what I've been watching and stuff. So they could be on that there. As a whole, I thought 2023 was a fantastic year for movies. Let's look at what we got from, like, big directors. We had a new Scorsese. We had a new Christopher Nolan, a new David Fincher, a new Alexander Payne and Ari Aster. We had something from Wes Anderson. We had something from Ben Affleck. Like, maybe PTA or Spielberg are the only kind of big-ish ones that I'm not thinking of. We got another John Wick. We got, you know, Marvel movies are dying down, and it's good. I guess I don't think there's going to be any next year. Maybe Deadpool, I think. Deadpool 3 is the only one. And there was a plethora of great foreign language movies as well, and a bunch of, like, indie movies as well that really kind of broke through. So who knows, they could be on the list as well. But I'm going to dive into it now because, quite frankly, I don't want to ramble on too long. And, you know, that's what you're here for. So I'm going to get into my number 10 movie right now.
The cyclone was coming at us from the east. We were sailing blind through the rain and the spray. My executive officer went into a panic. He repeatedly tried to order me off the bridge. I told him he was performing a mutinous act.
The trial counsel will state the charge.
Charge one, mutiny.
Did you relieve the commander of the USS Kane?
Yes.
Captain Queeg had lost control.
We had the commander under constant observation. You felt you had the right to depose a commanding officer on the grounds of mental illness.
Yes.
Did you think he was insane?
Can you describe when and where the captain displayed this aversion to danger?
No.
Why do his hands tremble?
Objection.
The honor and career of an officer with an unblemished military record of 21 years standing is involved.
counsel and the witness are herewith cautioned that they are treading on dangerous and unprecedented grounds here.
I don't understand what you're doing. I'm going to win this case. I have a chance with one heroic exec. Making that stick is the only chance for you to win.
He was a petty tyrant and utterly incompetent.
I've had a spotless record up until now, and I was stabbed in the back!
Are you testifying that Merrick deliberately violated his captain's orders?
It's the principle of respect for the command, and that principle was dead.
Did you offer to alter the logs?
That's a lie.
Answer the question, please.
It's a malicious lie.
Objection! The witness is being badgered.
Isn't it obvious that one of you is not telling the truth?
That was the trailer for my number 10 pick of the year. It's the Caine Mutiny Court-Martial. It doesn't say it in the trailer, the title of the movie. And you can't find, so little seems as you cannot find any clips, just the scene of the movie. But it is a fantastic film, in my opinion. Anyway, this is the final film from legendary director William Friedkin. You might know him. He did The Exorcist. He did The French Connection. More recently, he did something like Killer Joe. But one of my faves of his is To Live and Die in LA. He's an excellent, excellent filmmaker. And it basically shows how a good director can take something. It's a basic premise. It is a court-martial hearing. And he is able to create tension out of this hearing. And I do love a good, you know, court movie or lawyer movie or whatever. But the fact that this is set in the Navy and there's so many different rules to regular, you know, courtroom hearings, it's just it had me gripped. It certainly helps that the cast is excellent. You've got Kiefer Sutherland, who is basically the captain of the ship who had his ship taken over by his first mate, who is on trial for mutiny. He's Jake Lacy. You might know him if you watched the first season of The White Lotus. He was kind of the guy in his honeymoon that was a bit of a dick. And bad stuff happens at the end of that series with him. Gone too soon, Lance Reddick. He plays what is essentially the judge in this film. And the defending lawyer is Jason Clarke, who he gives good, like, every man stick. Like, he's like a bit of a gruff lawyer, no nonsense. You don't really know what his methods are. People underestimate him in it, but it's, to me, it is, it's just how powerful, like, storytelling on screen can be. And like, you start off and you're kind of like, oh well, you know, the guy on trial is kind of the bad guy. And then by the end, you're like, is Kiefer Sutherland, is he the bad guy? Is he a tyrant? Or, you know, it makes you see things from different angles as the movie goes along. And somebody sitting in a chair, so confident when they start, and by the end, you know, they're all flustered and it's tripping over themselves. I can't get enough of that shit. One of my favorite episodes of TV ever is Better Call Saul, Season 3, Chicanery, where Michael McKean, who plays Saul Goodman's brother, is on the witness stand. And if you can get somebody who is good at acting to kind of show that range of emotion and show that journey that they go on, basically there, it works so well for me. And Kiefer Sutherland does a great job in this. You get it on demand. I think it went straight to Showtime or Paramount Plus. I just loved this movie. And it's, you know, it's under 2 hours. And it just, it'd been a while since I saw a courtroom drama that kind of hooked, or got its hooks into me this quickly. And, you know, also, like, William Friedkin passed away shortly after, but Guillermo del Toro was his number two on set, just in case anything happened. And that kind of warmed my heart a little bit, just to see that, like, movie community looking out for each other. But yeah, I'd highly recommend this one. If you have any interest in kind of like procedural stuff, you should give this one a whirl. All right, on to my number 9.
Do you remember when you first met?
I don't really.
I don't know. Let me see. I met Joe. I remember knowing of his family. I mean, they were the only Korean family in the neighborhood at the time. Yes. And my son, Georgie, was in the same year as Joe at school. So technically, I would have met him there, but I don't have any memory of that.
Right.
Everyone's pretty close-knit here on the island, and you kind of recognize everyone. I know there was a point when he was friendlier with Georgie, but I didn't really meet him until he came to the pet store looking for a job.
It was summer after sixth grade?
Seventh. And then he started working there after school and on the weekends.
And what's it like with Georgie, your friendship?
I haven't really talked to Georgie much since then.
Georgie's very sensitive. He always was very, very sensitive.
What's your relationship like with him and your other kids?
How is that relevant? It's my understanding that the movie takes place between 1992 and 1994. Am I wrong? So why would you need to know anything that happened after that?
Yes, my number 9 is May, December, the Todd Haynes film starring Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore and Charles Melton as well. Actually, give him a shout out because he is phenomenal in his role. Basically, the film is based on a true-to-life incident that happened of a woman who was a teacher in school who had an affair with her student who was 13 at the time. I think she was 36, roughly around those ages. And they ended up getting married and have kids together. And in this film, it's not based on, you know, it's not explicitly those people. But Natalie Portman plays an actress who is going to be starring in a movie that is about this scenario that happens, and she goes to visit the couple and to kind of get a feel for her characters, and then a lot of feelings and stuff bubbles back up. And the movie itself it's directed by Todd Haynes, who has directed wonderfully beautiful films like Carol or I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan movie, where a bunch of other people play versions of him. But this movie, it really stuck with me. I think the idea is fantastic, but the way he goes about filming it is—it's like a melodrama, you know. It is heightened music cues, you know, dun dun dun, and stuff like that. And it's funny; it's darkly funny. Natalie Portman does some amazing work. There's a scene where Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman are in the mirror, talking and doing makeup, and Julianne Moore gives her a makeup lesson to kind of look more like her. And just the mannerisms that Natalie Portman picks up to mimic Julianne Moore, so subtle but really, really good. I don't know if it's going to get much awards traction this time around, because really it's such a crowded field. Charles Melton will probably get Best Supporting Actor, and he's great because he plays the he's a young man, he's 36, but he has kids who are 17, and when you're seeing, his son talking to him, they don't look that different in age. The son is probably in his 20s, really, and Charles Melton, I think, is 33, give or take. So, like, he's playing a bit younger, he's playing a bit older, and the son is playing a bit younger, but it's just kind of bizarre seeing them share a scene. They're like, oh yeah, they're not brothers, they're father and son. So there's a lot of that stuff that kind of keeps you off kilter. But the performances are excellent, and yeah, I just think it's a very interesting film that you don't see too many like, so I would highly recommend. It's on Sky at the moment, that's how we watched it. It's a Netflix movie, but in the States only, one of those funny ones, so you don't get it on the old UK and Ireland one here. But I'm recommending all of these movies, let's be honest, but this one, if you like good acting, people say it's camp. It's not really for me. It's more melodrama that will make you laugh and think. So give it a whirl, sure. On to number 8. See your face in the
Parisian. Wait, hold on. The Mona Lisa. There's an elite society with all the best fighter people in it?
Okay, so there's this lady, Jess Drew. Uh-huh. She rides motorcycles. Oh my gosh, I'm learning so much from her.
Oh yeah, I've learned a lot of stuff too. I've leveled up my whole thing.
Said,
see?
Oh yeah?
All of me
let's see then.
Let's go.
Thread the needle. All of my fears were already dead. And if I could remind you, if you could remind me of what I felt before.
And Miguel. The whole thing was his idea.
Right. And who's Miguel?
Miguel?
Oh, he's like a ninja vampire Spider-Man, but a good guy.
A vampire good guy. I'd pay good money to see that. So how long ago did they invite you?
It's only like a few months ago.
Months is kind of a long time, isn't it?
Okay, this one counts for two.
All of my feels were already dead. And if I could rewind it further, if you could rewind it, what I felt before I felt.
Look at you.
Look at me.
My number 8 is Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Something fun, change of pace from the first two. But this movie, first of all, I want to say I love the first one. I think I might actually like the first one a little bit more than this one, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. But this is a breathtaking movie. It's a work of art. Like, the animation style in it is fantastic. The emotional story as well is really, really good. This the premise of this one is basically Miles Morales is, you know, growing into his role as Spider-Man, and he's feeling more comfortable, but at the same time that has him drifting away from his parents a little bit, which is, you know, tale as old as time. And his primary antagonist in this movie, well, to begin with, is a character called Spot, or The Spot, I think, voiced by Jason Schwartzman, and he basically is a character from the first movie, like that an accident happens to him during one of the big fights. You don't meet him in the first movie. They just basically are clever enough to say, you know, this would have consequences. And he can, due to that accident, he can now like pop holes in the space-time continuum. And that starts to kind of fracture the multiverse, I guess, is the easiest way to put it. And then, like in that clip there, you find out that there's a whole society of Spider-Man across the Spider-Verse that are trying to keep the fabric of the multiverse together by making sure, quote-unquote, canon events happen, which I don't really care for that term. I don't mind the idea, but like for something to be canon in a comic book, yeah, it's a little winky to call stuff in your movie. If something is canon in comic book, in a comic book, it means, you know, when you're referencing it, oh, that's canon, that happened. But in the movie, to kind of say these are canon events, it kind of rubbed me the wrong, a little bit too cute. But it doesn't ruin the movie for me or anything, because the premise of this is that Miles is an outlier. He should never have been Spider-Man. The spider that bit him came from another universe. And if you've seen the first movie, the Peter Parker of that universe dies, and Miles kind of picks up the mantle. And in this one, he kind of, it kind of, you know, the whole thing is like, do you go along with this new society of people, or are you a rebel and you break away and go on your own? It's tremendously entertaining. Like I said, it looks fantastic. Some great voice acting. You got Daniel Kaluuya in there, Oscar Isaac. You have Hayley Steinfeld, who's playing Spider-Gwen, and they flesh out her character way more. I just thought it was brilliant. Best comic book movie I saw by a mile this year. Could win the Oscar for best animated feature, although Miyazaki, you would never count him out. But this one, I think it's on Sky as well at the moment. Give it a watch. It's so fun.
Yes, I see the train. What about it?
And you have a parachute.
Got a parachute? What do you expect me to do?
Well, just, you know, jump.
Just jump?
Yeah.
I mean, Benji, it doesn't work like that. I'm not that high. There's ledges sticking out everywhere. I'm going to hit them before the parachute even opens.
Benji, even if I could get the parachute open, yes. I don't know if
I can make it across the valley and intercept and land safely on a moving train.
Do you copy?
Yes, I copy. Look, I'm just trying to help you, okay? I need you to take a step back and pull yourself together, because I am under a lot of pressure right now.
You know that voice. Of course, my number 7 is Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning. I'm going to leave off the part 1 because I think they're dropping it as well. I love this movie. It is a mess, kind of, at times, but it is so thoroughly entertaining, I can forgive a lot of it. I mean, the fact that it's Tom Cruise, who's, what, 60, 61 now, still doing all this crazy shit, that'll always, you know, buy me an extra bit of goodwill. And, you know, I'm not going to spoil where I would put it in my, you know, rankings for the Mission Impossible series that we're doing at the moment. But I will say, like, in terms of, you know, action movies this year, it's probably up there. You know, it's my top one, I guess. I mean, I watched Fast X. Oh, God, it was so awful. I mean, John Wick 4 is also a superb action movie. The problem with John Wick, I find now, is it's repetitive, so it doesn't after a while, you're like, okay, fight, 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 fight. Lots of fighting. And there's some very good fighting in it, don't get me wrong. But what Mission Impossible, it's the variety. It's driving, it's running, it's fighting, it's bouncing off stuff. There is parachutes involved. You know, I'm sure we've all seen the clip of him jumping off the mountain. I mean, that's what he was just talking about there, with the parachute and the glider. Like, it may not be the tightest of the seven Mission Impossible movies, but it's still so bloody brilliant. It was a breath of fresh air. Now, they made a huge mistake in opening it a week before Barbenheimer, because it did not perform as well as they thought it would have. If they'd opened up a month earlier, I'd say it would have had such longer legs. But it doesn't take away from the quality of the film for me. The narrative is like it's a flop. Well, I'll talk about it when we get to that episode. But I don't know, like, he still has it. Hayley Atwell is in this movie. She is an absolute delight. God, it was great to see her being utilized properly in a movie. She's great in the first Captain America, but hasn't really done anything since then on the big screen. And I think she was a brilliant foil for Tom Cruise. We have most of the, you know, we've got Benji back, we've got Luther back, some of the cast from Six are back as well. I don't know, you're feeling a bit of the continuity stick as well, which I like. And yeah, I mean, it just has the funnest car chase I've seen this year. And I, you know, it just, it impressed me every time how tactile and how physical these things are. So it's always going to get a big smile on my face. All right, number 6.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm sorry. But I don't know. You come here, okay, with your opinion, and you tell me who Samuel was and what we were going through. But what you say is just, it is just a little part of the whole situation. You know, I mean, sometimes a couple is kind of a chaos and everybody is lost, no? And sometimes we fight together and sometimes we fight alone and sometimes we fight against each other. That happens. And I think it's possible that Samuel needed to see things the way you described them. But if I'd been seeing a therapist, he could stand here too and say very ugly things about Samuel, but would those things be true?
My number 6 with a bullet is another courtroom movie. It is Anatomy of a Fall, a French film directed by Justine Triet. And basically the premise of this movie is a man falls out of the top floor window of his chalet and dies. And essentially then there's a trial to see, well, did his wife kill him? And what I found really interesting of it was that there was no conclusive physical evidence, and yet the trial goes ahead and it kind of becomes more of a dissection of their marriage, a dissection of her, you know, identity, I guess, is the best way of putting it, without spoiling too much. They do a very clever thing about it where the only partial witness to what happened is their son, who is visually impaired, I don't think he's fully blind, but he can't see a lot due to an accident when he was younger. So he kind of takes the dog for a walk, and then he finds the body when he comes back. And it is fascinating to me because you don't know. You never know what's going on with a marriage or a person in general, really. And they kind of dig into that, and they dig, and it's 2.5 hours, and they dig and they dig, but it's never ever boring to me. It's also that kind of blew my mind because it's the French court system. So somebody could be questioned on the lectern, and then the prosecutor might just turns to the defendant an awful lot and like just starts asking her questions, and the witness is just standing there, and I'm like, wait a minute. Like, my understanding of courtroom proceedings is, you know, somebody takes a stand. They're the only ones that can be asked questions, you know, keep order. But apparently French court is like that. Everybody talks over everybody. And the guy playing the prosecutor is he's so fucking good at being like a smarmy piece of shit. You know, you hate him. Her defense lawyer is very good. He's like an old friend of hers. And as it goes on and more layers get unraveled, you're like, what? Like, part of me, like when I started, was like, oh, she definitely did it. And then you don't know. And that's the great thing about the movie, is that you can never really tell 100%. Because the character is quite cold, or maybe not cold, but like she's a bit standoffish. And that kind of gives them credence. And that's what they kind of like hang their whole case on. And when I'm sitting here watching, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills, being like, you can't just say that. But that's what makes it a good movie, that you're so invested in it. And it has one of the best needle drops of the year, in my opinion. The husband, before he dies, does this thing to piss off the wife, is play a song really loud on repeat. Like, he's upstairs and she's having an interview downstairs, and it is like a steel drum version of P.I.M.P. And it's just Chef Kiss. It's brilliant. So that's my number 6. And I don't know where you can find it. I watched it through my means, put it that way. I think it's in the cinema, so you can go watch it there. I'm sure it'll be popping up on some streaming service soon, because it is getting a lot of awards, recognition. It won a couple of Golden Globes. I think it won Best Screenplay at the Golden Globes. So it could be sneaking in there for the Oscars as well. But I check it out, guys. It's really fucking good. Okay, on to number 5.
Well, you made a good choice coming back here, because here,
I don't know,
your money flows freely here now.
Well, I do love that money, sir.
Don't call me sir. You call me uncle, or you call me king, like you used to. Remember?
Call you king?
Yeah.
King.
Hey, you didn't pick up any disease over there, did you?
No, no.
Sure?
I'm sure, sir. Sure. Not that I know of.
Keep that thing wrapped up over there?
I did.
Well, as best you could.
As best I could.
Yeah. You like women?
Oh, you know I like women. That's my weakness.
What kinds they got out there?
Just white. It's white that I saw.
Mm-hmm. You like red?
Red? I mean, that kind of red?
Mm-hmm.
I like red. I like white. I like blue. I like all of them. Don't matter to me. I'm greedy. I like the heavy ones. I like the heavy ones, the pretty ones, soft. Ones that smell good, you know.
Well, we got to keep an eye on you. You're just going to run all over the place.
Killers of the Flower Moon here at number 5. What can you say about a man like Martin Scorsese, who at 81 years of age is still producing absolute epics? This one is not as flashy or as fun as things like Goodfellas, Wolf of Wall Street, The Departed, you know, stuff like that. But it is beautiful, it is moving, it's tragic, it's impeccably made, like amazingly acted. DiCaprio is giving us something that you haven't really seen from him before. He's really, really good. De Niro is like a snake, like a, or like the embodiment of evil. I don't know, you look at him and I just see like this kind of like archetypal character, but he infuses it with so much more. It's his best turn in years. If you compare it to his previous collaboration with Scorsese with The Irishman, I think it is such a level up from that performance. A different character, sure. But I think this is, you know, at 3.5 hours, it's not one of his ones that you're going to go back to, because it doesn't move the same way, you know, Goodfellas or Wolf of Wall Street move. And they're both 3 hours, give or take. This one is like meditative, but like, it's important. It's an important story, I think, after watching it, like, and shows what kind of a country America has built itself, or how it has built itself. The story, like, is that the Osage, they have a little title card at the start that says they are the wealthiest nation per capita in the world at that time, and how just the white man just comes and absolutely sucks them dry. There's some stuff in it that is super disturbing. There are funny moments in it as well. Like Brendan Fraser, I think, is great. And I think people were kind of critical of his character, but like, he made me laugh out loud in this movie at the end. There's funny moments as well, because they're dealing with idiots. It's not some grand conspiracy where they cover their tracks. You know, they kill a bunch of people to get their oil money, and they're not even like hiding it so much. That's such an indictment in itself. Like, it takes 2.5 hours of the movie before the FBI show up. And that's the other thing as well, that they changed it from, you know, DiCaprio being the FBI character come to solve the murders, to him actually being complicit and one of the main collaborators in this scheme. It's, you know, available on demand now. It's on Apple. I was lucky enough to see it in the cinema, and I'm delighted I did, to be honest. I will watch it again, but it's one that, like, it took me a while to shake. It's 100% worthwhile. It's essential viewing, I would say, because it could be Scorsese's last movie. You know, like I said, he's 81, he's a couple more lined up, but you never know what could happen. And if this was for one for him to go out on, well, I think it's absolutely fantastic. All right, on to number 4. Maestro, fucking Maestro. God, I loved this movie. I enjoyed it so much more than I thought I was going to. I mean, I really enjoyed A Star Is Born, to be honest, and I was very impressed at how well Bradley Cooper transitioned into directing. This movie is very well directed, as you could hear from the clip there. It gets very bombastic. That is Bernstein conducting in a church, and it's Bradley Cooper. I don't know if it's a 6-minute unbroken take, but it's a 6-minute scene, and like, he is doing the work for all of it, sweating profusely. I've watched a clip of like side by side comparisons, and it's uncanny. But also, he brings this like realism to a character I didn't really know an awful lot about, but it's such a natural and kind of human performance by him and Kerry Mulligan, who plays his wife Felicia Montalegre. And it's a character study of their relationship, I guess, more than anything, because it doesn't really, it's not a biopic. It's not like, oh, and Leonard Bernstein learned how to play the piano at 6, none of that, or it kind of almost skips over a lot of his pivotal points in his life, you know, writing West Side Story or when he became a huge television success. They're alluded to and stuff, but like really it's about their relationship, and like it hinges on the performances. And I mentioned on the podcast that like the first half or first third of the movie is a very light, and it's, you know, how he gets his big break to be a conductor for the first time, and then he meets Felicia, and then they kind of start their relationship, even though he is a gay man. I think a big part of it is like people are telling him that it'd be easier if he was married, but also you can tell that there is like a attraction, there is a connection between the two of them. And she states that she is fully aware of, you know, who he is and what his situation is. But as the movie goes on, you can kind of see the toll that takes on her with whatever Leonard gets up to. And in the second half of the movie, it really, the camera kind of pulls back for a lot of it. And it's like you're an intruder almost, or it's like you're a voyeur spying on their relationship. It's really, really good. And an hour 55 for a, you know, what could be deemed, you know, well, the usual biopic is normally 2.5 hours. If I hear that is what it is. Like Elvis was on the other night, which is amazing, don't get me wrong, but it's 2 hours 40 or something like that. Like, and it has so many big highs in it. But I was so relieved almost when I saw the runtime. I was like, oh. And it's one that I think I will be revisiting quite regularly, just because I was so impressed with it. So it's on Netflix, you know, it's right there for you guys. I can't recommend you check it out enough. And again, an hour 55, it's, you know, 2 episodes of some TV show you're watching, but way better. Okay, number 3.
Thanks for convening on short notice.
I can't believe it. Well, here we are.
This is atomic test.
The Russians have a bomb. We're supposed to be years ahead of them, but...
What
were you guys doing in Los Alamos? Open discussions.
Too many compartmentalization was supposed to be the protocol.
We were in a race against the Nazis.
And now the race is against the Soviets.
Not unless we started.
Robert.
They just fired the starting gun. What's the nature of the device they detonated?
Data indicates it may have been a plutonium implosion device.
Like the one you built at Los Alamos.
Number 3 with a bullet. It's Christopher Nolan's masterpiece, Oppenheimer. This was my number 1 for most of the year, up until like the end of November, I think. This was chugging along top, and it's the best film I've seen in the cinema this year. It is 3 hours, and it feels about 90 minutes. It fucking zips along, and, you know, it shouldn't, I guess, because a lot of it is just conversations that are being had. But the way it moves, the way the script is structured, and the way it is edited, and the way the lines are delivered by, you know, the cast of like 100 like great actors as well. Like, you know, you got Cillian Murphy, who is phenomenal. He's probably going to win the Oscar for this. I think it's his best performance, although he does slip into a bit of the... Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood. Like, you do kind of get a bit of, oh, is he doing a Daniel Plainview impersonation at times? For me, anyway, that's what I got. But he is still very, very good. I mean, the other one is my favorite performance of all time, so, you know, if you're kind of doing an homage to that, or you know, even anything close to it, I'm gonna be impressed. But like, Robert Downey Jr. is fantastic. Like, he still has his fastball, which is unreal, because he seemed to be done. Like, even his post-Marvel stuff, you're like, oh, it's so self-indulgent, it's so crap. Like that Doolittle movie, it was as if nobody was challenging him on anything, and and now, like, say, somebody like Nolan, who's a master filmmaker who likes things done a certain way and is going to get the best out of his actors, like, is getting the best out of them. Emily Blunt is fantastic as well as Oppenheimer's wife. Can't remember her first name at the moment. Kitty, maybe? You have great, like, small performance. Like, Josh Hartnett is back in this, and he is brilliant. He oozes movie stardom. Like, I would love for this to be, you know, a catapult for him to be back. You know, give him a movie where he can be, like, a charming rogue or something like that. Put him in a Shane Black movie. You have Matt Damon, who's just fucking Matt Damon, you know. At this point, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get a minimum 8 out of 10 from him. He's funny in it. He is gruff in it. You know, Catwell was making fun of that line, because it's the most important thing in the world. But when he says it, in the moment, you're like, you're fucking right. Like, Krumholtz, he's having a career renaissance with this. You know, I love seeing his face. You got a bunch of other people, like Josh Peck is in it, and not to mention, like, Florence Pugh is there. You get, like, these A-listers coming in to do, like, 5-minute jazz sets, like Gary Oldman as Harry Truman. You have fucking Kenneth Branagh as Niels Bohr. Like, it shouldn't work. It's a masterpiece. Like, it shouldn't work. And, you know, I've seen it once in full, and because we have the Sky Store at home here, there is, like, an all Oppenheimer channel, and Faye would, like, come in and she's like, what are you watching? I'm like, Oppenheimer. She's like, you're watching it again? It's just that good. It is such a watchable movie, and, you know, it's probably going to win Best Picture, Best Director, all the stuff. I think Best Actor, I think Bradley Cooper gives a better performance, but he's not even my best actor for this year, you know. So I don't know, it's all a bunch of rubbish anyway. This is a great movie. It's out for download or whatever. You can get the 4K Blu-ray. Buy physical media, guys. HMV is back open. Golden Discs are doing 2 for 30, 4Ks and all. I'm getting off topic. But anyway, we're into the top two. Oof.
I find music a useful distraction. A focus tool. Keeps the inner voice from wandering. My process is purely logistical, narrowly focused by design. I'm not here to take sides. It's not my place to formulate any opinion. No one who can afford me needs to waste time winning me to some cause. I serve no god or country. I fly no flag. If I'm effective, it's because of one simple fact. I don't give a fuck.
I really should have said this is number two with a bullet, considering the film that it is. It's The Killer with my boy Michael Fassbender by The Finchman. This is a movie I will watch 20 times, like, at least in my lifetime. It's catapulted into that category of, like, I'm just going to stick it on and, you know, watch the process. Like, this is one, it's about 2 hours. First 20 or 30 minutes, hypnotized by it, I think. I know Andy tried to watch it. He said he turned it off after 5 minutes. That just shows the difference between me and him. I could sit there and watch Michael Fassbender stretch and put together his rifle and look around the plaza, go eat a fucking egg McMuffin, listen to his music, you know, while he blathers on inanely before he, like, has to, you know, shoot somebody. The genius of this movie is its screenplay juxtapose everything that is happening on the screen, in that Michael Fassbender has all these rules, he says he's doing all this stuff, whatever, where he's constantly fucking up in the movie, and it's not played for laughs, it's played straight, and that's what makes it funny. You know, they're not trying to gurn or be like, ooh, whatever like that. Like, he'll say something and then on screen, immediately the opposite will happen. But it'll happen, you know, deadpan. And I just think that's hilarious. The action is really good. Like, there's something about, say, somebody making an escape, a quick escape on a bike. And, you know, it looks tactile and it feels real. And, like, just their every little motion is like, oh, that's the work of a professional. Like, oh, there's a scene where he's on a scooter and he has to throw his weapon away and he's able to, like, get it into a drain first time, and you're like, fuck, that's good. It kind of becomes a bit of a revenge movie. Like, you know, he fucks up a job and then somebody he loves gets hurt. And then he goes one by one up the chain to kind of pick out the people responsible. So it's broken into like five acts, five parts, whatever you want to call. And each part is like a little, you know, vignette. It's something different. And I'm mesmerized by it. It's in my bones. And I know it's not for everybody, but I just love this movie, man. I have it in Fincher's. He's, you know, if I was on Marc Maron and he asked me who my guys are, it'd be Fincher, it'd be PTA, you know, Scorsese, whatever. But, like, I don't know. I rewatched all his movies this year and he has, like, five genuine masterpieces, and I would have this just below them. Like, he's an unreal filmmaker that we don't get enough movies from. So I was delighted to see this back. And, again, it's on Netflix. You can watch it there. It's great to see Fassbender back, locked in, doing good stuff as well. Somebody was giving him bad advice there at the back end of the, you know, the teens, shall we call them, because, I don't know, he had a run of terrible, terrible movies, and he was checked out as well. So it's great to see him back, on form, locked in. I wonder what is to come from him next, and I bet you're all wondering, what is coming next? Well, it's number one.
I can tell by your faces that many of you are shocked at the outcome. I, on the other hand, am not, because I have had the misfortune of teaching you this semester, and even with my ocular limitations, I witness firsthand your glazed, uncomprehending expressions.
Sir, I don't understand.
That's glaringly apparent.
No, it's... I can't fail this class.
Oh, don't sell yourself short, Mr. Coates. I truly believe that you can.
I'm supposed to go to Cornell.
Unlikely.
Please, sir, my test's gonna flip out.
All right. In the spirit of the season, I suppose the most constructive way of dealing with your shortcomings is to offer a makeup exam. You'll all get a second run at this after break. Of course, it will not be the same exam. You will now be responsible for new material as well. Your grade will be an average of the two. Please open your books to chapter 6. The Peloponnesian War, gentlemen.
My number one movie, The Holdovers. This was one that I liked the idea of it when I saw it, the trailer first, that it was kind of like, oh, it's a throwback to, like, you know, a 70s, 80s kind of slobs versus slobs comedy type thing. And then I'd heard about the reviews and, you know, thought it was quite good, and although some people kind of gave it a mixed review. And then when I watched it, I was like, blown away is not the word I would use. I was deeply affected by it. Like, I was thinking about it for days afterwards. It's a beautiful movie. It made me laugh, made me cry, made me feel a bunch of stuff that I haven't felt in a while. The character arcs in it are fantastic. The performances, I mean, this is my best performance of the year. I think he should win the Oscar, Paul Giamatti, playing this character, because I don't think anybody else could play it. So somebody else could probably play Oppenheimer. Somebody else could probably play Maestro. But like, I don't think anybody else could play this character and play it so well. Like, he starts off from the clip, you could hear like a kind of pompous jerk that, you know, the premise of it is he has to stay behind in this prep school where he teaches and look after the kids that, you know, aren't going home for Christmas. So it's essentially, it's like set over the course of 2.5-3 weeks. And the growth of the character you get within that time frame is just brilliant. And it's hard. There's bits in it that are absolutely heartbreaking. There's a point in the movie where you allow yourself to think that something is going to happen, even though in the back of your mind, you know it's not going to happen. And then when the thing you knew wasn't going to happen happens, you feel shit. But you don't feel anger at anybody. It's just one of those things. And I was like, God, it was like you allowed me to dream for a little minute. And it gives, like, and Giamatti gives the most natural performance. It's like hopelessness. He gives the, like, in that moment, you know, he gives such, like, epitomizing hopelessness that I was like, oh. And he's kind of like, I allowed myself to dream for a little bit. I'm kind of making it sound depressing. It is funny. It's a comedy a lot of the time. there is a scene of just him going out for a walk in the snow. And I was like, holy fuck. Like, he just is that character. He embodies it so well. You couldn't imagine anybody else doing what he's doing. And it's just little movements. It's just him flapping his arms or the way he walks or attempting to throw a football. But it's just brilliant. And like the support cast as well. Divine Joy Randolph, who you might know from Only Murders in the Building. I think it's the second season. She's a cop in it. Or maybe she's in the first season as well. She's a Broadway star, but she is brilliant. She plays a woman who is grieving the loss of her son in Vietnam. He was a student at the prep school. And I just, it's like you're watching somebody that you know, that you've met, you know, around the community or whatever. It's just a real person. It's not an actor, you know. She's transcended that, as pompous as that may sound. And then Dominic Sessa, the young guy, apparently he just went to the school where they were filming. He'd never acted in a movie before. And this guy is incredible. Like, he's going to have such a huge career ahead of him if he wants it. He kind of brings a level of honesty, like earnestness, neuroses. But he also is like brash. And like, his character goes through a bunch of changes as well. It just, when you finish watching it, I think, anyway, this is how I felt. I was like, I let out of like a, I was like, that was a fucking movie. And they don't make movies like these anymore. It's going to be one I think we'll watch every Christmas. And yeah, it's like different from the other Alexander Payne stuff that I've seen, which is kind of normally a bit more like pointed and a bit snarky. Like, I love Election, don't get me wrong. But like, this is softer and warmer, and it's exactly what I need. It's why it's my favorite film of the year. Well, there you have it. That's my top 10 for the year of 2023. I'm going to wrap things up fairly sharpish now because my voice seems to be giving out on me. A couple of films that I didn't get to get on the list, but I thought were great nonetheless. Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. That's on Prime Video. A lovely, lovely movie. Go watch it for Rachel McAdams alone. She is an angel. John Wick 4, excellent action movie. It'll be a little bit long. I'd recommend How to Blow Up a Pipeline on Netflix. A brilliant thriller about a bunch of eco-terrorists. It's like a ticking clock. They're cooking with something, that movie. Air, also on Prime Video. It's the Shoe, Michael Jordan Shoe movie, directed and starring Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. He knows how to make movies. I'm glad he's back doing stuff. It's just really enjoyable. Like, didn't crack the top 10, but I had a great time watching it. And a special word, I guess, for Barbie, which is a great movie. It kind of confounded where I thought it was going to go with it. Ryan Gosling is amazing in it. He's not going to win Best Supporting Actor, I don't think, but I love how insane he gets in it and how committed he was to things. If you haven't seen it already, I'd recommend you watch it. Some of the messaging gets a little bit mixed for me towards the end, but it's still very enjoyable. Lots of funny stuff in it there. Okay. 2024 looks like it's going to be a good year to start anyway, because we still have a few leftovers from 2023, like Poor Things and The Iron Claw and Ferrari, that they're up this month, I think. But the rest of the year, I don't know. The good movies will be there. You just might have to find them a little bit harder, because we were spoiled this last year, I have to say. Guys, we will be back with Mission Impossible 4, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, Monday, and we still have a lot of fun with that mini-series there. I'm going to try and maybe filter in some more solo content onto the main feed. Might sneak it in there for you, but I hope you enjoyed listening to this little sojourn I had taken. And I'm going to leave you with possibly my favourite joke of the year from any movie. It's a great tune. It's by the man I was talking about earlier on there, Ryan Gosling. This is him singing Push by Matchbox 20. Guys, have a great time, and I'll talk to you next week.
Said I don't know if I've ever been good enough. I'm a little bit rusty and I think my head is caving in. And I don't know if I've ever been real in love. But here let's touch me and I feel like something's got to give. And I'm a little bit angry. Well, this ain't over. No, not here, no. Not well, I still need you around. You don't own me. We might change, yeah. Yeah, we just might feel good. I wanna push you around. Well, I will. Well, I will. I wanna push you down. Well, I will. Well, I will. I wanna take you from ground down. I wanna take you from ground down. Yeah, yeah. Highway. Ever won by me, cause I'm a little untrusting when I think that the truth is gonna hurt, yeah. And I don't know why you couldn't just stay with me, couldn't stand to be near me when my face don't seem to wanna shine, cause I'm a little bit dirty, oh well, don't just stand there saying nice things to me. I've been cheated, I've been wrong to you. You don't know me, yeah, but I can't change. I won't.